Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
What's good, everybody? Welcome in. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast, episode 12. Ben Heisler with you, and the Awful Announcing Podcast is, of course, presented by our good friends over at Clip It. Watch, clip, share, watch, create, and share clips of memorable moments right from your phone with the Clip It app. Download it today on your Android or iOS device. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, you will hear Ben Koo's conversation with ESPN's Adnan Virk. Very excited to have him join the show today, especially on Oscars week, because if there's one thing that Adnan does, and he does a whole heck of a lot at ESPN, a jack of all trades, you've seen him on ESPN's baseball coverage, he's calling games, he's in the studio. Same goes with college football and college basketball broadcast as well. And just to make sure it's pointed out, according to the Dan Le Batard Show, Adnan Virk looks like the undercover CIA agent who saves James Bond by killing a crime boss's henchman, then smiles wide, extends his hand, and says to 007, "Mr. Bond, welcome to Tangier." That guy is our guest this week for episode 12 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Excited for you guys to be able to hear that conversation that he had with our fearless leader, Ben Koo. But before we do that, it is time to play our game. Give you an opportunity for you guys following us at Awful Announcing on Twitter to guess who our guest is going to be this week. And today we are joined by Pat in New Hampshire. Hello, Pat. How you doing today?
Great. How are you guys?
I'm good. I appreciate you joining us today. You correctly identified that Adnan Virk would be our guest this week on the podcast. Pat, are you familiar with our game?
I am.
Wonderful. Okay, so we got two clips for you. If you get them both right, it's $50 to Amazon.com. Get just one, it's $25, and if you get none of them right, well, unfortunately, you have a wonderful experience to share, but unfortunately, nothing to show for. You ready to play?
I'm ready.
Okay. This first clip was actually courtesy of the Olympic Games. This athlete, after celebrating a win, let a few F-bombs fly. I need you to tell me who that person was. Take a listen.
I would probably want to fake. There is his dad coming in. He said, moments ago, his dad said, "I've never seen him cry."
Pure emotion from this Olympian. Pat, can you tell me who that Olympian was?
I cannot. I didn't watch any of the Olympics, unfortunately.
All right. Well, that's okay. It was, in fact, Shaun White, the Olympic snowboarding champion. But that's okay. Yeah. You still got an opportunity to win up to $25 over at Amazon.com. And this clip is a little bit more fun. But if you didn't watch the Olympics, maybe you're a fan of hockey coverage. I want to give you a hint here. This SNL comedian actress was not having it when this man associated with hockey coverage on NBC decided to interview somebody on the U.S. team regarding their losses to Canada mid-game. I need you to tell me who Leslie Jones was so upset about in this clip, and viewer discretion is advised.
Okay, asshole, why the fuck would you ask her that right now in the middle of a fucking game that she's playing right now? Thank you. Thank you for putting that in her motherfucking head. You know what? Get your ass the fuck away from the hockey players. You know what? I swear to God. I swear to God. See, when I go, y'all lose your fucking mind. What the fuck would you ask her that for?
All right, Pat. Can you tell me who Leslie Jones was so infuriated by for asking that question?
Pierre Maguire.
Nicely done, and a full recovery from Pat in New Hampshire. Congratulations, you got one out of two right. That means $25 to Amazon.com. That's courtesy of our friends over at Clip It, the number one way to share your favorite movie clips, television clips, whatever clips you want with your family and friends. Download the Clip It app today on your Android or iOS device. Pat in New Hampshire, appreciate your time, and we will talk to you again soon. Thank you for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Congrats to Pat in New Hampshire for winning $25 to Amazon.com. Coming up on the other side, Ben Koo's conversation with ESPN's Adnan Virk. Do not go anywhere. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by Clip It.
Welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
That ball hit deep to right, and that is gone. Welcome to Tangier.
A home run for Bradley Zimmer, his eighth of the season.
And then you were waiting all night to the damn GeoCon, but you finally get it in.
That's our guy, Adnan Virk, on the call, the highlight courtesy of ESPN, as we welcome you back to the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It. Excited to hear this conversation. Ben Koo sat down with Adnan Virk. Two of them had a wide variety of topics to discuss, including his start, his big break at ESPN, and of course, because Adnan's on the show, you had to talk movies, so of course the guys did. Here is the conversation with Ben Koo and ESPN personality Adnan Virk.
So a few days back, you kind of poked fun of an article I wrote back in 2011 where I basically said, I had no idea who you and Max Bregos were at the time, long time ago. And I thought it would be kind of good to go back and retrace your progression at ESPN. Can you take me back to 2010 and kind of tell our audience where you were in your career, how that came about, and what was that decision like to not only switch companies for yourself, but also move your family to a different country, a different setting?
Yeah, well, listen, first and foremost, Ben, thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm obviously a huge fan of you and of Awful Announcing, and I can tell you without a word of a lie, I have always taken much awareness, I should say, of what people like yourself are saying about me. And maybe that can be a blessing or a curse for some. People can say, just, tunnel vision, just do your job. But I'm like, no, I want to know what people are saying. And especially if I read your website, if I follow it on Twitter, if I agree with the vast majority of opinions, I want to hope that these guys think I do a good job. So I want to just begin with my Awful Announcing indoctrination, which was I was doing an Outside the Lines probably around that time, 2011, and it was about, listen, it sounds so tired now and hackneyed, but at that time, I swear, it was one of the first shows you were doing about NFL and concussions and that kind of thing. And somebody tweeted from that, I don't think it was you necessarily, but somebody tweeted from the Awful Announcing account, really enjoying this Out to the Lines. Adnan Virk is way underrated. And I tweeted back, I said, oh, this makes my day. And I wasn't kidding. Like, if you get any sort of feedback, you're 31, 32 years old, you're, like you said, a Canadian broadcaster working in America. You're in this bubble when you're in Bristol. You just assume no one's ever watching you. Even though you're on TV, you go, wow, but I'm on ESPN News. And fine, that day I was filling in on OTL, but maybe someone sees it's not Bob Lee. They change the channel. So I just want to start by saying that. Trust me, every little bit of feedback we get, and everybody pays attention, just like athletes who say they don't read what people say about them. Trust me, all broadcasters are well aware of what people like yourself say about us. So thank you, first of all, for the kind words over the years. And that article you cited, the reason I mentioned it, because I had Max, who's a dear friend of mine. He's a wonderful guy. He's so funny, and he's so generous and so warm-hearted. He's leaving Bristol for Los Angeles, and the good news is he's staying with ESPN. But the bad news for me is I'm losing the guy that I enjoy anchoring with more than anybody. And that show that we did that you happened to mention, we started, and this is what we kept laughing about, is that year of 2010, unfortunately, I'm the only one left. Sarah Walsh, Don Bell, Steve Weissman, me and Max, I'm the only one now still in Bristol. And we were saying, would anybody have ever imagined that one of us two yokels would still be here in Bristol? And that's when I brought up, this was on the most recent Cinephile podcast, I said, hey, remember that Awful Announcing article about us? And Max started laughing. And he said, yeah, and he told the story. So that article that you'd written, it was very flattering. It was the headline was funny. As you said, it said the most unrecognizable SportsCenter duo of all time. But then in your article, you did say, hey, I found these guys pretty darn entertaining. They're pretty good. And so as Max told the story on Cinephile, my pod, and which I'm now happy to tell your listeners, is the fact that we then went to our talent office. So again, we take this seriously, okay? We then went to our bosses and said, look, these guys at Awful Announcing, look at the title, Awful Announcing. I don't think they like people normally, and they liked us. They think they're pretty good. Can you put us together more often? And then, of course, we never get to work together really ever again. So we were always laughing, saying it's almost like maybe the people saw Awful Announcing. They go, okay, well, hey, it's awful. And obviously, these guys can't be good. But I love working with them. We had such a blast together, and I was so grateful that you had written that so early. I mean, you were prescient, Ben, the fact that you kind of knew you were honest. And at the very least, that Max and I had great chemistry, which is certainly true. And as I said to him, I knew we were going to be good friends and at least good broadcasters, at the very least, together. When I, over a Brian McCann home run, said, do the can. And when it was Max's turn to talk, he said, okay with the Moulin Rouge references, but please don't mention Australia. And I just started losing it, the fact that he was able to pick up at such an obscure reference. He also reminded me, which I had forgotten, that I used to say on Hunter Pence, I used to say, sixpence none the richer, swing, swing. And he said, why don't you just say, Hunter, sixpence none the richer? You'll eliminate the word. Or how about even better yet, get rid of the stupid line because it sucks. So we would always have fun together. He loves movies like I do, but he's a little older than me, not much, but a few years. And he grew up in Australia, so I love talking movies with him because he will tell you how great an actor Mel Gibson was in The Road Warrior. He can tell you about how John Carpenter's Escape from New York is his favorite movie. He loves John Voight, which I said to him, you know, I'm a Pacino De Niro acolyte. I don't meet anybody who says John Voight's my favorite actor except for Max. And he does the best impressions of Sean Connery and Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole and all those great British actors. So, yeah, your article was, the fact that we brought it up, then I had to tweet the picture out again since he's leaving Bristol. But it was, listen, it was a watershed moment for us at ESPN. Don't kid yourself.
I'm appreciative of that. I mean, it speaks to, you know, there's been a lot of time in between now and then. And obviously you've kind of moved up. But I'm kind of curious, like, how did that initial transition from young 30s broadcaster in Canada translate to your opportunity at ESPN? How did that come about? Was it nerve-wracking, you know, moving from, you know, Canada where you had lived your whole life, you had, you know, you were familiar with where you worked? I mean, that's kind of a big change of scenery, a big opportunity, and I don't have much backstory on how that kind of came together.
Yeah, the backstory may be the most interesting part of it, so I'll trace you back a little bit. So I was working at a place called the Score Television Network, which has become a breeding ground of so much talent. We're like the 94 Expos back in the day. Sid Sixero, Tim McAuliffe, Cabral Richards, my good friend Cabby, Elliot Friedman, who's in hockey day in Canada, Greg Sansoni, Tony Ambrosio, Martine Guyard. There was so much talent that we had there, but we were the number three network. You know, in Canada, it was TSN, it was Sportsnet, and then we were number three. And now the Score has been disbanded. Now it's been swallowed up by Rogers Sportsnet. So it no longer exists, but all those talented people are thriving in their positions. And I was grateful to be working at that company. But when I left, I had kind of sensed that, you know, things were eroding a little bit, at least for me personally and professionally. And my boss there at the time had said to me, you should try to work in the States. And I said, why are you trying to get rid of me? Anthony Ciccone was a great boss and a good friend. And he said, no, I just think you're talented and you know, you're at that age enough where you're young enough, you just got married, that you can go to the States and you don't have any hang-ups, you know, do it. You should be ambitious and strive to be the best. And Dave Rutherford was a great boss. Our news director gave me the name of an agent. It was actually, coincidentally, Robert Smith, who now does a great job on Fox, college football analyst. And I got to work with Robert, of course, at ESPN, who's a great guy. And Robert was our NFL guy for the Score in Toronto. So obviously he would always join us via satellite. So I remember Dave got me Robert Smith's agent's information. I sent him my tape. He passed. He sent to another guy. He passed. And then a third guy who was in New York said, if you'd like to meet, I'd like to meet you. I'd like to represent you. And his name was Mark Turner. He was a good dude. I went down with a couple of buddies. I said, let's just go to New York anyways, and we'll go have a good weekend, catch a ball game, whatever, have a good time, go out, and then I'll meet this guy, and hopefully we'll go from there. And he said, listen, I like your demo. I'm willing to represent you. You don't have to sign anything. If we get a deal, I get 10%. But other than that, you don't have to pay me anything. And I said, yeah, this is a win. So Mark was sending my names. And to give you a sense, Ben, this is, you know, 10 years ago. This is when I think MLB Network was just starting. So remember, he sent my tape there. I said, oh, I love baseball. It's my favorite sport. And he said, they have a little bit of interest, but no, not really. Then there was, I think, I want to say CBS Sports Network, maybe. I remember because looking it up, Chelsea Peters. Okay, what exactly is that? Yeah, sure, I'll do it, whatever. And then he said, Lori Orlando at ESPN says she'd like to meet you. She doesn't have a job, but she'd love to meet you. And I said, great. And at the time, it was me, my wife, Eamon, and our son, Yusuf, had just been born. He was just a little baby. And we drove down. I've never called in sick. I swear under false pretense. But this time, they said, you got to come down. And they gave me a few dates. And one of them was Thanksgiving in Canada, which is the first Monday in October. And we were just doing rehearsals for a morning show. And I said, oh, God, Ben, it's just a rehearsal. And I kind of joked to one of the guys, do you really need me for a rehearsal? And they're like, well, yeah, like rehearsing the show. Like, don't take it, you know. And so I said, well, what the hell? So I said, I threw my back out. And I said, okay. I said, but hopefully I'll be okay for when the show actually debuts. We're doing a new morning show. But I said, for a rehearsal, sorry, my back's killing me. And it's Thanksgiving Monday. I can't get to a doctor. Okay, fine. We drove down Sunday, 8.5-hour drive to Bristol, Connecticut, stayed at some $50 motel. I get up in the morning. I meet Lori Orlando. She's wonderful. She's very engaging. She seems interested in me. I talked to her for 30 minutes. I talked to Dave Roberts, who is running ESPN News, for about 20 minutes. Dave Roberts, by the way, now is like running First Take. I don't even know if you remember that I met him 10 years ago. But then he was actually running ESPN Radio a few years ago, so me and Dave's path crossed again. But I drive back. Mark says to me, Lori said, if I had a job, I'd hire him tomorrow. I said, oh, my goodness, this is October of 08. So I went back to work the next day. I remember one of the floor directors was like, oh, he's walking gingerly. I'm like, why am I walking gingerly? Oh, that's right, my back injury. Yeah, I'm feeling better. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, the 17 hours of driving to ESPN in 2 days, that's what the back injury is. And then I waited. And here's the best lesson for anybody out there. You think it's going to happen, and then it doesn't happen. So then what do you do? my good friend David Amber, who was invaluable in eventually getting me the job at ESPN, was working at ESPN at the time. Good friend from Toronto. We'd worked together at TSN. David was on air. I was behind the scenes as a young wannabe on-air personality. And he would send me, he said in January, or I started, you know, Deuces, my old buddy Deuces Rogers, September of 2009, got hired. And then he said Steve Weiss and Max Brados got hired, January 2010. And I said, I don't understand. What happened to if I had a job, I'd hire him tomorrow? She just hired three other anchors. So I would send Lori notes every few months. Just, you know, and it's a great line. Chris Berman once said it on a show I saw. And he said, there's a fine line between being persistent and a pain in the butt, and only you know what that line is. So I would send Lori a note, hey, here's some of my material. I just interviewed whoever. Chris Bosch, I just did the story on Vernon Wells. Take a look, whatever, have fun. And I was at the point where I said, literally, it's the all is lost moment. It's January of 2010. It's New Year's. I said, I'm just going to email and say Happy New Year's, and that's it. And it's Happy New Year's, and she goes, hey, I mean, great to hear from you. We're actually looking to hire someone. Can you send me your latest stuff? And I said, oh, my God. I tell this story to kids all the time. I said, you never know. People forget, okay? Maybe they meet you. They have a good connection. Then they forget about you. Who knows? People are busy. You got to remind them. I'm still here. And once I remind, and maybe, who knows, maybe Lori was going to contact me. Maybe I should give her the benefit of the doubt. But once I emailed, she got back to me right away. Put a tape together. I went down there. I want to say Valentine's Day of 2010. They do a full rehearsal, man. ESPN did not mess around. And David had told me. Amber was invaluable. I sent him the list of all the names I was meeting, and he was perfect. Oh, Mark Gross, yeah, big Red Sox fan. He's from the area. You talk with him about that. He loves restaurants, golf. Talk to him about that. Yeah, Al Jaffe, longtime talent guy, big UConn guy. Talk to him about that. So I already had crib notes from David on each person that I was meeting. And he said to me, they're going to do an audition. And what you do is make sure you watch, because you're in Canada. You're not watching this stuff. Watch the 11 p.m. Sports Center the night before. Because what they're going to do is they're going to have the A block, which is the first part of the show, and you're going to do it. You're going to write your own on camera and go from there. And it was helpful they did that because it was all college hoops. It was Syracuse. It was UConn. It was whatever. And he said, find out who the producer is. And even you tell them, hey, listen, I have a lead into whatever story that'll let you do it. And I had a good line of, I read a story about Calhoun, and I wanted to make a Death of a Salesman reference, which is one of my favorite plays. So I loved the line, attention, attention must be paid to such a man. So I remembered, I said, no matter what, even if I don't get the job, I can say I made a Death of a Salesman reference while doing my audition for ESPN. And the audition went well. I mean, the biggest thing, Meg Green, who's still in the talent office, had said to me, make sure you talk slow. And I talk fast all the time, on air, off air. And she had said to me, no, I'm not telling you specifically. I just find a lot of people when they do this, because the adrenaline, they're so amped up, you know, just they go really, really fast. So I said, okay, that's generally my Achilles heel anyways. And I always try to tell myself, make love to the words. So I probably went as slow as I could have for me, which is really tough to do. But the audition went well, and I felt confident. I felt really good afterwards, and I had a good talk with Al Jaffe. And the only thing I remember, Al asked me afterwards over lunch, he said, well, how much college sports do you know? And I tried to impress upon him. I said, listen, I work at a station called The Score. We have the NCAA rights. So I covered the Final Four. I was in Detroit in 2009. That was the year North Carolina won. Michigan State was in the final. And that was that great stretch for Izzo and company. So I said, no, trust me. Mark Rose says to me, you got the job. And I said, great, I'll tell my boss. I was now working at a place called Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. So I was covering the Leafs, I was covering the Raptors, and I was covering Toronto FC. And he goes, well, not yet. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you got the job, but, you know, my understanding is the immigration process could take a while. And I said, oh, okay. And he goes, you got to get a what's called an O-1 visa, and then eventually apply for a green card. And so I've heard this could take up to 6 months. I said, are you kidding? I got the job at ESPN, but I have to wait for 6 months and not tell anybody? Like, that's insane. And he said, listen, I'm just telling you, that's the horror stories I've heard. Now, thankfully, it took literally a week. I remember I got, and I'm not kidding, Ben, it was like 80 pages of documents. It was insane how much stuff I had to go through. And Greg Sansone, my old boss at The Score, called me and goes, hey, I know we haven't talked in a little while, but I got a call from someplace in America. They wouldn't say who they were, but they're doing a background check on you. They wanted to know if you're ever involved in criminal work and what kind of a person you are. So I gave you a rave review, but I hope you're okay. I hope you're not embezzling funds or you're involved in fraud. Talk to you later. But thankfully, like I said, it was maybe a week later, and I got the job end of March, and I started in May of 2010. And like I said, I had a great crew with me, Weissman and Max and Sarah Walsh and Don Bell. We all started around the same time. Like any company, you always gravitate to the people that you first start with. But I had wonderful anchors I purchased with Deuces Rogers and Mike Yam and Anish Shroff and Kevin Negandhi. They're all very welcoming to me. Dari Noka was a wonderful guy. Steve Bunin, Mike Hill. Like I really reflect upon those memories. Jonathan Coachman. Really well, because all those guys, we all kind of felt like we were doing it together. And I think a big misnomer about ESPN is now you see me and people go, oh, he must have been pinpointed as a college football guy. No, ESPN hires you, and then they figure it out. There was no plan for me. No one said to me, oh, this is where we see you. It's just he did a good audition. he seems like a good guy. Let's give him a chance. And once you get the job, then you have to really work hard. You know, people say to me, you got the job at ESPN, now what? I said, no, now is the hard work. Now when you get there, you have to meet with people in the talent office and say, okay, I really want to do baseball. Okay, Mike McQuaid's the guy who runs baseball. You have to convince him. Well, he's got Carl Ravitch, he's got Steve Berthew. Okay, well, you have to somehow convince him, persuade him to put you on the show. Well, you want to do NFL, you got to talk to Seth Markman. You want to do college sports, you got to talk to Lee Fitting. So there's so many levels to ESPN that I didn't realize, that if you're asking about my journey, I never realized how many steps there were. Most companies, you work at a station, you have a news director, you have an executive, and that's about it. Here, there's so many different levels of command, and it's so siloed at times, which can be positive, at times which can be to a detriment. But I've been really fortunate that I've been able to work hard and get good opportunities. And I've got great people around me, man. Seriously, they all make me look good. And I've been fortunate.
You really set me up for my next question was, in between then and now, you've really kind of added a lot of responsibilities and gigs to what you do. And I'd be curious, what do you think was the biggest break for you professionally there? Was it College Football Final, Baseball Tonight? You might be overly obvious that it could be the MLB All-Star Celebrity Game, but
Joplin Announcing has been a vigorous supporter of. honestly, Ben, what I've always heard from Jerry Madelon, who used to be in our talent department, and he would be in all those meetings. So this is how they do these meetings. They literally do the schedule. So all those different bosses who represent those different sports and those different sports centers, they literally sit in a room. Like, it's like the five families. You say, all right, well, who's doing this shift? Who do you want at this 11 p.m. sports center? Who's doing the 1 a.m. this day? And you go from there. And so for me, part of it, I had to convince Mike that I wanted to do baseball and I could be a part of it. And I do look back as that first Baseball Tonight, which was August of 2011, and I started in May of 2010. That, to me, was a tipping point. It's my favorite sport. I got to work with the now manager of the New York Yankees, which I'll never stop tired of saying, so I'm so happy and so proud of him, Aaron Boone. And Boone could not have been nicer to me that night. So that was definitely memorable. I did my first Baseball Tonight. Tim McHugh was a coordinating producer, was very favorable towards me, and he started sending me to L.A. I thought that was big. I got to work with Neil Everett and Stan Barrett, two guys who I think are, obviously huge stars and great guys, and both were very welcoming to me. That, to me, I think was a big deal, to go from an anchor who's primarily on ESPN News, who's now in L.A. for a week on that show. The loop is so huge, right? That airs for 8-9 hours. I thought that was big. But Jerry told me the biggest moment for me, he felt, was getting Mike and Mike. And he said, what happens is that show is seen by everybody. And all the executives who work here saw that show. And whereas previously you're working on 5 to 8 ESPN News with Max, and no one's watching that. All due respect, they're watching SportsCenter on ESPN, or they're watching live events. They're not watching you guys do your thing on news, except for our direct bosses, who were wonderful. Alita Whithoff, Mo Hassett, Lindsey Street at Cubs, who were all very supportive. He said that those bosses were over seeing the bigger sports, the bigger properties. Once they saw you on Mike and Mike, they said, oh, this guy's great. He's funny. He's engaging. He's quick on his feet. He's good at ad-libbing. And then they said, okay, I want him on my show. And that led to you starting to get a push in other departments. And radio is something that I'm proud to say it's just something that I was able to do myself. I quite frankly conned them into it, because Scott Mastiller was the boss, and Pete Genesini was still there, and Pete's been the real guy who's given me the green light on Cinephile, which has been huge for me. But I went to them, and here's the reason I wanted to do radio. Dari and Coach have both said to me, because I noticed those guys would do radio on the weekend, and there was three reasons to do radio. It's fun, it's more money, and it's more exposure. And I said, you know what, I'm enjoying the TV thing, but for those three reasons, I'd like to dip my toe in the radio. And I somehow convinced or slash hoodwinked Masteller, because he goes, well, have you done radio? And I said, well, yeah. But all I had done was, 10-minute hits on Toronto radio talking about the Raptors. But he took that to mean I did a three-hour show. I'm like, sure, yeah, I've done radio. Great. And I would fill in for the Doug Gottlieb show, which was from 4 to 7. And Doug was great, very supportive of me. That's why I met Dan Stanzik, who's now my producer in Cinephile, who's an unbelievable talent and a great guy and very loyal. And it would be me and Mike Salk. Then that led to me and Russillo being paired together. And Russillo was unbelievable, because I didn't know anything about radio, but Ryan does know a lot about radio. And he's smart, and he's funny, and he gave me that room to grow, and he let me talk movies, and he let me talk about the Flyers or the Eagles or stuff that I'm into that probably most people wouldn't be. But he's like, fine, he loves Roger Federer. Give him a minute on Roger Federer, and it'll show his personality. He was very generous in that. And that was September of 2011. And then me and Golic got the step in May of 2012. And I knew it was a big deal, okay? You know when these moments happen. This is the number one sports talk radio show in the country. All right. When their show ended, I tweeted to Greeny. I said, you know, Mike Greenberg's favorite movie is Casablanca. And just as everybody comes to Rick's in that movie, everybody comes to Mike and Mike. Every major guest goes to Mike and Mike. Every person watches Mike and Mike. There are people at my school, my kids' schools, who are not sports fans who all know, oh, you're the guy who fills in on Mike and Mike. And I think that Jerry was right. That was really a tentpole for me that people said, oh, that's the guy. Literally, Ben, I would do 20 shows a year versus 200 of television, and people would recognize me wherever I am. Oh, you're the guy who fills in on Mike and Mike. So I think those moments in particular are big, and particularly the college sports quickly. I filled in just doing what's called college basketball rap, so that studio with Seth Greenberg and Jay Williams. And John Wildback, who was our VP at the time, he said to me after he saw me with those guys, he said we need to put him – into more of a host role. He said, I particularly liked how you worked with the analysts. I thought you were quick on your feet, which, again, helps from doing radio where there's no script. And John told me it was kind of his idea to say, listen, let's get him out of the Sports Center mold. I don't want to see him hosting a conventional Sports Center. I like him on live event. I like him with other analysts. Now, Lee Fitting, who oversees college sports, will tell you, I think maybe more was his decision, or at least he was definitely heavily involved. He said, no, I saw your work, and I said, I want Adnan. And I was the one who made the decision to get you on College Football Final, and once Reese got the jump to replace Fowler, it was Lee. So I don't know for sure if it's Fitting or Wildback, but both those guys were big supporters of mine, and it's been kind of crazy now for a Canadian to be working primarily in college sports at ESPN. That's probably the craziest part of this whole journey.
So you mentioned that Mike and Mike was a big step up for you, and often when I'm doing my night owl things, I'll see you like on ESPN doing morning shows. You're on a lot of different platforms doing radio, filling in. Ultimately, would you like to see that as your primary role down the road, having your own show, you know, either paired with someone or just, you know, by yourself? Is that kind of where if you had, you know, if Iger or whoever ESPN's new president is and sits you down and says, hey, where are you in 5 years? Is that kind of where you would ultimately like to steer your career going forward at ESPN?
The most fun I've ever had is when I got to fill in for Keith Olbermann. And it's no secret to anybody who meets me that Keith is my favorite broadcaster. When I first started at ESPN, Lori Orlando and that talent office said to me, who do you like on ESPN? I said, of course, I love Dan Shulman, fellow Canadian. He's brilliant. I said, but I love Keith. And when I first worked at TSN, I was a 19-year-old intern. And, of course, you don't, for those who don't realize, in Canada, you don't get ESPN unless you have it contraband. So the fact that I worked at TSN, that's where I got to first watch ESPN programming. And when I came to America in 2010, yeah, of course, I knew who Chris Berman was. I knew Stuart Scott, Linda Cohn, Steve Levy. Because, of course, I knew them because the hockey coverage, Bouchagross. But I got to first watch Keith when I was 18, 19 in college. And I would come in and work at TSN. And I would watch the American Sports Center, and I got to watch Dan and Keith together. And I said, this guy's unbelievable. And everybody there knew, like, oh, yeah, Patrick and Olbermann, these guys are huge in the States. But, like, literally, I don't want to sound like a dinosaur, but this is 98. Like, this stuff isn't rampant everywhere. This is okay. The Internet's only been around a couple of years. And I would watch Keith, and I go, this guy's the best. He's so funny. He's so smart. I love his writing. He's incredible. So I would obviously have always followed his career, and I love his work, whether it's in sports or news or politics. And I was so lucky I got to meet him in 2008, I think around that time. You know what? It was the closing of Yankee Stadium. He happened to be there, and I introduced myself, and I said, oh, I watch Countdown every night. I'm from Toronto. I DVR the show. And he gave me like 20 minutes of his time. He could not have been more generous. I'll never forget that. And even after I asked Keith for a picture, he was really great to me. I never would have imagined that the highlight of my career working at ESPN is filling in for Keith. Like, I don't know what was more incredible, the fact that I was filling in for him. I was the number one fill-in for Olbermann. I did 25 shows, or the fact that after Keith's very public exit from ESPN the first time, that he came back and hosted a show a second time on ESPN 2, and now he's back again. Like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Right? It just shows you were the one who alerted me to that. I saw your tweet about Keith doing PTI this week, and I said, oh, my God, this is great. He's back again. And by the way, when I did Mike Golic and Wingo last week, when we had Keith on, I said, oh, how am I introducing him? Can I say he's back? Oh, my God, Olbermann's back. They said, well, don't say that. I said, what am I supposed to say? They said, well, just call him contributor. I go, really? I go, yeah, just ESPN contributor Keith Olbermann. And I sent him an email. I said, I'm going to call you a contributor. He's like, yeah, whatever you want. I said, I'm here. I'm around. Like, I'm going to do this stuff, which is a long way of saying not only the personal appeal of filling in for him, somebody whose work I so respect and admire, but the format of the show was such a blast. He had a great crew. Dave Cerosi, his longtime coordinating producer, he was with Keith at MSNBC. J.B. Kritz, who's a friend of mine, a researcher. Matt Collette, Matt Katanik, Darren Dimitario, you know, the entire crew. Dan Riemann, these guys are awesome. And so this entire crew, imagine someone says to you, you know, this is a writer, okay, what are you hot on today? Oh, I think, you know, Roger Federer is the greatest athlete of all time, which I tell everybody all the time. Okay, great. You want to do a five-minute commentary about how Federer is the best? Yes. Great. So you write it, and then they fix all my mistakes, and they beef it up, and they have researchers, so they make it funny, more interesting, and they know my personality, so they, okay, oh, you might want to add this line here, or this is kind of goofy or silly, or this might work here, and we'll develop the over-the-shoulder graphics, which fits so well, and then guest-wise, oh, we know you love baseball, great, we already bought Kirkjian or Buster or whomever's going to come by, and then the C's will do some highlights and call it a day. Like, that show was perfect. Anybody who's a personality, anybody who resembles a personality wants to showcase that. And Olbermann was such a great showcase, I thought, for me. And I've definitely met people. Kevin Burkhardt, who I think does a whale of a job at Fox. He's so great. I'm so envious of his job, by the way. He gets to host the World Series, and he's the number two NFL guy. I'll put that play. He's so good. Burkhardt reached out to me, like, on Twitter. Was like, hey, man, I know we don't know each other, but I think you do a great job when you fill in for Olbermann. And the compliments that I got from doing that show, they said, listen, Keith is a big name and a big presence. If you can go in there, listen, ask anybody. If you're watching Colbert and Colbert's not in that night, you're probably not going to watch it. But so if you want to watch Keith and you see my face, you go, wow, Keith's not in today. If you can hold that audience, if people go, you know what, this guy's not bad, he's decent, that's a huge win in that arena. So in answer to your question, if I could ever do any show, it would be that Olbermann-type show. Commentary, highlights, a guest, call it a day.
So moving on to kind of what's topical is you're a huge movie guy. That's how we became a little bit friendly on Twitter and so on. You're going to be covering the Oscars again this year, your second year. I'd be curious, is Sunday your favorite work event to cover?
Yeah, you know, it's a blast, man, and there's really one person to thank for this, and that is Ben Lyons. Ben is unbelievable. He's a better version of me. He loves sports and he loves movies, diehard Knicks fan. His dad's a celebrated film critic, Jeffrey Lyons, worked for years in New York, still goes to film festivals all the time. And Ben's the guy who first used to hear Cinephile. And by the way, the genesis of Cinephile was this. I just went to Pete Genesini and said, listen, I'm never going to get my own show here, it feels like. I'm not going to get my own radio show, but I'd love to just talk movies. And if you're willing to give me that space, you know, I'll do it for free. I'll come into my day off. I'll book the guests, whatever you want. And Pete was great to say, sure, I'll give you the latitude to do it. And, of course, the great Dan Stanzik, my producer, who is working for free, by the way, while still producing, Golic and Wingo 5 days a week, is like, yeah, I'll do it with you. And then people get interested, and it starts to create a little bit of buzz. And you were kind enough to reach out to me and say, oh, yeah, listen, man, I thought it was good. This is interesting. And then all of a sudden, like I said, Russillo, invaluable. I go on his show. You want to pump up Cinephile? Sure. Tell us what guests you got, et cetera. The talent office, Lisa Stokes and all of her department, Carlton Gillespie. Oh, listen, do you want Willem Dafoe for 5-10 minutes? Yeah, of course I would. Like, they were invaluable. Again, Robert De Niro is coming here. You want him for Cinephile? Sure. Viggo Mortensen, whatever you want. So all of a sudden, you get some guests. You get people buying in. You get shared passion. And Ben was listening, and then he had messaged me. By the way, Ben does a great job for NBA TV, Turner, but he also works for ESPN LA 710. And he had messaged me in January, and we had talked maybe once or twice on the phone previously. I knew who he was. Obviously, I knew his dad. I knew he'd worked at E! News for years. And maybe I'd had him once on with me and Russillo filling in. But Ben messaged me and goes, listen, I love Cinephile. I'm trying to get you to the Oscars. I do something for Oscar.com, Second Screen Experience. But maybe I could come on Cinephile sometime. And I was like, great. And so he came on my pod, and it was just, hey, tell me about your life story. Like, I grew up watching John Candy movies. Was your dad teaching you about Akira Kurosawa and Federico Fellini? Like, your dad's a film critic. Tell me about it. Tell me about your life as a reporter. You replaced Ebert. You faced controversy because of that, et cetera. And Ben was a great guest. And afterwards, he's like, all right, man, let's work on this Oscars thing. And of all the shocks of my life, the fact that he made it happen. Think about how many times in your life someone says, oh, I'm going to make this happen. It never happens. He made it happen. He got me the Oscars. I got a call from my agent. He goes, yeah, the Academy would like you to work on Oscar.com. And for those that missed it, what I'm going to be doing again this year, while you're watching the Oscars, which you should be doing on ABC, Jimmy Kimmel's great, also on your second screen, just like the Megacast, as we do for college football, on your laptop and your computer, put up Oscar.com, singular, O-S-C-A-R, and you'll see me. And Ben said to me, this is all it's going to be, man. It's just you and me talking. So someone's going to be in our ear, along with Sophia Carson, who's great. Someone's going to say, literally, Guillermo del Toro just won Best Director. And we're going to start talking about The Shape of Water and del Toro's career. And he goes, you're going to be great at it because you do live TV, so you know how to fill the time, which can be 10 minutes of us yapping. And you love movies. You have such a shared passion for this. You'll have no issue talking about Pan's Labyrinth or Pacific Rim or del Toro being another Mexican director to win, et cetera, et cetera. So I can't believe I've been to one Academy Awards. That feeling when I first walked on the red carpet which I'm going to be doing shortly. It was unbelievable. There's been two times I've had that feeling. One was my first Sports Center, which was the Michelle Bonner. You know, they used to do those flashing lights on the Sports Center set. I remember looking up and going, oh, my God, I'm having an out-of-body experience. I can't believe I'm hosting the Sports Center. And the second one was definitely the Oscars. Not the telecast, because by then I was backstage. I was into it. That first walk down the red carpet, it's so bright because there's so many cameras. There's just light everywhere. And I'd been there for the rehearsal the day before, and I remembered how dirty the carpet was. And I'm like, oh, the red carpet's pretty messy. Like, it's just, I never forget. And it was just me and Ben hanging out. He's wearing like a Knicks sweatshirt. We're just joking around. The next day, pristine red carpet. Everyone's dressed to the nines. There's cameras everywhere. It's organized chaos. But it was amazing. And the biggest thing they kept telling me, don't take pictures. Like I said, I just want to, you know, do a video of Meryl Streep. No, you cannot do that. Only if you have the camera icon on your pass can you take pictures. And so Mahershala Ali, who made history, the first Muslim ever to win an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, I'm friendly with him because my friend, my cousin Salim, rather, knows him well. And so I had texted Mahershala, and I was like, he'd been so great to come on the podcast. We all knew he was going to win for Moonlight. So when I saw him, the biggest thing is I got to get a picture. So thankfully his PR person took a picture of me and hers together. And Barry Jenkins, who had been so great to me, I reached out to him via Twitter. He started following me and followed me back. And I said, can you come on my podcast? And I said, sure. This was in November. And Barry's the guy who directed Moonlight. And so when I saw him on the red carpet, I'll never forget this. When I saw him, I hugged him. We got a picture together. And I said, hey, man, I think you're, you know, you got a good chance tonight. Like, you never, like, I know La La Land's a heavy favorite, but I think you have a puncher's chance. I'll never forget, Barry looked at me and goes, yeah, I think you're right. And I always think of that moment because 4 hours later, this guy's life changed. Like, it was the craziest mishap ever. Everybody knows that they messed up the envelopes. But I saw Barry Jenkins, and I saw him later, and his entire life has changed. He's an Academy Award winner for Best Picture, and he's such a good dude. He's humble. He's a big sports fan. He went to FSU, so we were talking, and I think we were talking Seminoles football, literally, minutes before he's about to win the Academy Award Best Picture. Danny Cannell stories. But Barry's awesome. I'm going to see Barry again this year. I'm going to see Hirsch again. So that event was so crazy. You know, of events that I haven't covered, I've never been to a Super Bowl. I would love to do that. I'm an Eagles fan, so we finally won. It would have been nice to be there in Minnesota, although it was a little cold. I've never been to a Stanley Cup final. The big one for me is Wimbledon. I'd love to go to Wimbledon. A lifelong tennis fan. My mom loves tennis. It's her favorite sport. She grew up in England, which is why I love Wimbledon so much specifically. It's the cathedral of all the majors, and I adore Federer, and, of course, that's his home. So in a sports vein, I think Wimbledon would be the one I'd love to go to. But the movies, I can't believe I'm going to be able to say I've been to the Oscars twice.
So I'm pivoting towards this year's Oscars. If people were looking to cram a film or two in, you know, the Best Picture nominees before Sunday, and this is more for kind of a broader audience,
sure,
not maybe the art house crowd, what would be two, you know, a few that you would try to suggest to try to, you know, fit in between now and Sunday so they were a little bit more engaged with this year's Oscars?
No, it's a great question, man, because even one of the researchers today on Golic Wingo, Brett Prada, asked me that. And you got to cram, what do you got to watch? And I said, well, listen, the good news is this. The two that people have seen are Dunkirk and Get Out, right? The Dunkirk made $500 million worldwide. Get Out was an enormous success. The fact it was made for under $10 million in gross, I think over $200 domestic, is amazing. So at the very least, of the nine Best Picture nominees, there's a good chance the majority of people watching will have seen two of them. The bad news is Dunkirk is going to get shut out in the major categories. Christopher Nolan, I would have bet my mortgage, he was going to finally win a Best Director trophy back in July when Dunkirk came out. Now he's just going to get nominated. There's no chance he wins. Guillermo del Toro won the Director's Guild Award. He's won everything leading up to it. He's going to win for The Shape of Water. But at least if you've seen Dunkirk, it might win some technical categories. You can say, okay, I've seen that. And Get Out, right now, this is the best race going, best original screenplay. I think it's going to be Martin McDonagh for Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. But Jordan Peele has a really good chance of pulling off the upset for Get Out. So if you've seen Dunkirk and Get Out, which I think most people have, you have at least a basis. Now, if you need to cram right now, here's the way to go. The Best Picture race is coming down to three movies, and now it's actually two movies. I thought Lady Bird had a really good chance for this reason. Nobody dislikes it. Everyone likes it, or they loved it. So the balloting system, the way it works is that, you know, in the case of La La Land, the reason it didn't win is people that loved it or really hated it and said, God, this movie is so self-absorbed and ridiculous, or they found it enchanting. But it gets knocked on your ballot, whereas Moonlight was universally well-liked. So I thought with Lady Bird this year, maybe it'll get enough of the tabulation, right, the overall votes to win. But honestly, it's fallen off in the race. It's not going to be that. So if you've got time, there's two movies to see. One is the one that I think is going to win Best Picture, which is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. It won the SAG Award for Best Ensemble. It just won the BAFTA, and obviously there's nothing British about that. And this is the British Academy Awards that just gave it Best Picture. It's going to win Best Actress for Frances McDormand. It's going to win Best Supporting Actor for Sam Rockwell. And like I said, I think McDonough wins for screenplay as well. The people that love it, as did I. I thought it was the Best Picture of the year. The only word to describe it is ferocious, it's audacious, it's unpredictable, it's all over the place, it's unlike anything you've ever seen. Now, it's also a little polarizing. There's a bit of a backlash to it. And the reason why it may not win is the character of Rockwell is this virulent racist. And those that are not voting for the film say that he's redeemed by the end of the film. How can this character be somewhat heroic? Now, I would argue it's partial redemption and nothing in life now, you know, politics, whatever it is, everything's always black and white now. Well, no, this guy obviously is a heinous character in many ways, but he has some signs of humanity. And it's a testament to Rockwell's acting and the way McDonough writes it that you're able to see that this guy is not just a one-dimensional jerk. So I don't agree with that backlash, but there's enough of a backlash that the other movie you should see might win Best Picture, and that's The Shape of Water. 13 Academy Award nominations. It's definitely going to win for Best Director. I have all my picks on goldderby.com under Experts Picks. For all those I know that loves their gambling, I'm not a gambler, but I do understand the idea of the Oscar pools, which I think is a ton of fun. So if you want to know best live action short, best animated short, trust me, I've seen all the shorts. That includes live action, documentary, animation. I've seen all the animated films. There's five of those. That's easy because I have three kids. I've seen four of the five documentaries. Right now I'm trying to cram in foreign films, which is just tough to get to. I mean, Central Connecticut, for God's sakes. So unless someone sends me the movies, it's very tough to find these movies. But The Shape of Water, 13 nominations. I think it's going to be a little bit like Life of Pi, which Ang Lee won Best Director. I believe it won Visual Effects and those technical categories. It did not win Best Picture. So I think this year we're going to see a repeat of that. If it does win, though, listen, nobody dislikes the film. Everyone agrees it's a beautifully made movie, gorgeously photographed, a very sweet story. But I think it might be a little bit too weird. I mean, literally, if you're telling people, and you alluded to it by saying the art house crowd, well, this is an art house crowd movie. This is a mute woman in love with a fish man. And I think for conventional audiences, they're going to go, God, this is just way too out there. But I think it's a movie for movie lovers. It's a real hearkening to 1940s stories. And the story is very timely. Del Toro wrote it because this is the best way of describing The Shape of Water. It's Beauty and the Beast if the Beast never changed. And it's really a film in which he's trying to embrace outsiders. And Richard Jenkins' character, who's this closeted gay neighbor, Sally Hawkins, the mute woman at the heart of the story, this monster who's being terrorized by the great Michael Shannon, who plays so many villains and plays them so memorably, Octavia Spencer, who's the black cleaning woman, who, of course, is ostracized because it's taking place in the 60s where racism exists. So his movie is about outsiders being accepted, but I just think it's a little too weird for the mainstream. I think Three Billboards ends up winning Best Picture.
So you briefly mentioned that you make an effort to see all these movies and you have one documentary you're short on. And I'm kind of curious, what's the perfect movie experience for you? Is it at home, maybe going to a theater that has a recliner and cup holder and good snacks?
Now we get to the real question,
so
too.
You can hear the reactions of the crowd. Do you like it, you know, where it's middle of the day matinee so you can park and get good seats? I mean, what's the optimal Adnan Herc movie viewing experience?
You nailed it at the end, my man. I have three boys, 9, 6, and 1. So when the 9 and 6-year-old are in school, the best chance is the weekday matinee. While the baby's napping, get a sitter. And my wife and I can go catch a 1 o'clock matinee, or sometimes she's not interested. If it's a little too artsy for her, I'll go by myself. That's perfect to me. I've got a theater 10 minutes from my house. It's always empty. I like being in the empty Monday matinee by myself, and I can just indulge. I don't need audience reaction to influence me, but I do love a big screen, especially a movie like Dunkirk. I did go with a few of my friends, Dan Zicks, Steve Cerruti, Rob Lemley. We had a blast. Max Bredos, we all drove down to Mystic, which is an hour away, and that was a real IMAX 70-millimeter experience. But generally, I like to be by myself, and ideally, I like to be in the movie. I mean, my wife's great. She's obviously not yapping the whole time. She's not. She does pull out her phone once in a while, which I'm big on. I don't have my phone on. I turn it off immediately. If I'm with other people, I would tell them to turn their phone off. I will chastise them publicly if need be. But that's why I just honestly, man, I just like to kind of be in the mood myself, because I find that, listen, you're a good dude. If you and I went to the movies together, just naturally I would be wondering, hey, does Ben think this is good? Is he into this? Like, Lyons and I went to a bunch of movies at Sundance together, and it was funny. The one movie was so horrible, and I kept thinking in my head, does he think this is a good movie? And at one point, an hour in, he turned to me and just goes, welcome to Sundance. Like, okay, good. Thank God. He knows this is a bad movie, too. This isn't just me. That's ideally for me, but again, as I mentioned, with three young boys, I don't get to the movies as much as people think. I think people honestly think I go to the movies every day. Trust me. I go once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. Honestly, most of the time I'm watching stuff on DirecTV, so oftentimes movies that are in theaters, they will often come to DirecTV as well, so I'll watch at home. I don't have a lavish setup. I don't have home speakers. I have a 41-inch screen. I have a Blu-ray player. That's about it. There's really nothing too crazy. I don't have popcorn dispensers. I don't have reclining seats at home. I'm just happy to watch them. You know what I mean? I'm at the point now when you got three kids, you go, I don't care what the experience is, I just want to be able to watch them. When I really get to, you know, geek out, like when I adore Scorsese, as you know, when Silence came out, I made the trip. I went to New York City, you know, watched it by myself, opening night, that kind of thing, because it's Marty. But normally I'm not going to that kind of extravagance. And I never used to be this guy either. Now I'll watch stuff on my phone or laptop or iPad if I have to. You know, like those documentary shorts I was talking about. Listen, that doesn't have to be seen on a big screen, and God knows it's not coming to Hartford. So I'll get a link from these publicists who have been invaluable.
Oh, I mean, you're killing me. You gotta Apple TV it. You can. No, you're
right.
The same screener soon, but you gotta get it back on the big TV.
You're right. It's a good point. My wife will. I'm technologically foolish. So you're right. She will set it up with the Apple TV and we'll get screeners. But there have been times I watched LBJ because we had Rob Reiner on Cinefile. He was great. And I got the screener and I think she was busy. So I said, I'll just watch it on my phone. And it was not great. Trust me. I would much rather have experienced it in a big theater. But it was fine. It was doable. But you're right. If my wife is home, like the screeners, the shorts that we got, we watched it on Apple TV. So at least it was on the relatively big screen, bigger than what I had otherwise.
So on the subject of your wife, I'm curious your thoughts on how important should overlapping movie taste be to a romantic relationship? Would you say you and your wife share similar taste there?
Absolutely. When we first, we got to know each other, is a nice way of putting it, I think I asked her, because, you know, I love the movie Diner. You know that movie?
Barry Levinson. I was
correct.
Just giving someone grief for not seeing Diner and American Graffiti. I'm not going to talk to... No, let's just publicly out him. This is Sam Blazer, considers himself a movie buff, and has not seen Diner or American Graffiti, and he's on the shit list until both those things happen.
Oh, I just don't talk to people like that, Ben. I just go, you know what? Just go watch them, and then we'll discuss. We'll revisit our friendship then. But Diner, remember the scene he gives the sports quiz, right? Because he's such a big Baltimore fan. So with my wife, I kind of gave her a bit of a Godfather quiz, because she had said to me she was a big Godfather fan. I said, okay, let's test this. I don't remember all the questions I threw out there, but the one I did say was, what was the sergeant's name who Pacino kills in that famous scene, along with Sollozzo? And she said McCluskey. And I said, okay, any woman that knows the guy's name is McCluskey, who Pacino shoots in the head, that's good enough for me. So she loves movies just as I do. I'm so thrilled I'm going to be able to bring her with me this year. As thrilled as I was to go to the Oscars last year, I felt really bad. I couldn't bring her or my producer, Dan Stanzik. It was a one-man band that Lyons was able to get me. But Ben had said to me, when you go, hopefully next year, just ask them to bring a plus one. So this year when they invited me back, I said, listen, it would mean the world to me if I could bring my wife, Eamon, as well. She's a huge movie fan. She loves the Oscars. I'll get my parents to come down from Toronto, look after the kids. And they said yes. So she's on a cleanse right now. She's fretting and the dress. There's always a lot of stress going on right now. But, yeah, trust me, man, she's as into it as I am. Listen, are her tastes as obtuse as mine? No. There's certainly movies she'll watch me watching going, I don't understand how you sit through this stuff. But she's more inclined to watch a lot more stuff than I think people would realize. She's definitely artistically minded. She loves The Godfather, as I mentioned. She loves Pacino and De Niro as much as I do, which I don't know many women who do. She loved The Shape of Water. She thought it was beautifully made. But there's certain things. She loves it. You know, here's one. You and I both love it. Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson. A lot of her family does not like There Will Be Blood, and she loves it as much as I do. So that's the best compliment I can pay her. And she loves Phantom Thread as much as I do, which I was worried about, because I know, again, that's not necessarily the mainstream taste. But she agreed with me that it was brilliant.
So I have some rapid-fire movie questions, just kind of digging to see your movie taste and history.
Yeah.
What is a movie that you can't believe you've seen at this point?
Well, this is going to be funny. Now I'm going to be on your list now as well. And I'm holding firm to these just because I can have this answer and people ask me. I've never seen West Side Story. I've never seen Sound of Music. I've never seen Singing in the Rain, which when I told Tim Kirchner this, he goes, okay, I see a theme here. You're not big into musicals. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I'm aware of them. I've seen the Gene Kelly dance sequence. I'm aware that The Hills Are Alive with The Sound of Music. I'm aware of the Von Trapp family. I don't need to actually watch those movies. So those are the three big ones. The one that will offend you and will offend anybody who loves a good comedy And so I really should rectify this one, is Animal House. I've never seen Animal House. I'm aware of Food Fight, John Belushi, yep. Otis says that we're coming, whatever. That is one that is probably a big one that always gets the reaction that you just gave me. Ooh, no, Burke.
And another question I sent you in advance, you can kind of think about it, is, you know, let's say, hypothetical, I don't know what this could be for, but you are sentenced to life in jail, and you part of the judge sentence is you cannot have cable or satellite, but you can have a TV with a DVD player, and you can bring 5 DVDs with you. I could have also phrased this as you're on an island with a TV or a DVD player. I don't know why I went with the more.
No, I'm glad that you went prison, because normally people go island, and that's a little darker, which is more to my taste, as you know. So I will give you the answer, which is just my favorite movies, and I'll give you what's the proper answer. So my favorite movies are, of course, Scorsese and De Niro, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas. I'm going to cheat and call Godfather 1 and 2 one movie, and then I'm going to say Glengarry, Glen Ross.
Love that call.
Yeah, so there's all those 5 are not only among my favorite movies, but as you noted with Glengarry by your reaction, that's a great rewatchable movie because the dialogue is so good and so much fun I can watch it over and over. Now, I do also love Do the Right Thing. I love Malcolm X, but I just don't think Malcolm X, you know, 3-hour biography, I'm not sure if that's going to play when I'm in prison. So let's be honest, I should get some comedies in there. If you want my favorite comedies, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is a movie I absolutely love. I've probably seen it as much as I've seen any comedy, and I love The Naked Gun. So a real list would somehow include Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and The Naked Gun, especially if I'm in prison withering away.
And what is the most disappointing you've ever been seeing a movie where you had heard good things? I always think that's the worst, where everyone likes it, and then you get excited, and then you go and you think everyone else is crazy. What's that movie for you where it got built up, you went, and it just fell on its face, and you everyone who suggested it to you is now kind of like on a list of people you don't trust anymore?
I'll give you a couple of recent vintage. One, I was so excited, again, as I mentioned, these movies don't come here with frequency. So whenever they open in limited release, these Oscar-type movies, I've got to make crazy efforts to go. Now, an hour drive isn't too bad, especially since you used to live in NorCal, so you know that's kind of routine. But I remember being so excited, I had to drive like an hour 15 to go watch Foxcatcher, which I had heard into rave reviews at Cannes. I said, oh, my God, Bennett Miller, I loved Capote, of course, which he directed. You've got this great cast of Tatum and Ruffalo and Carell playing against type as John Dupont, and I had read the book. And then I got there, and I said, man, is this movie slow. And I said, when is this thing going to pick up? And afterwards, when it ended, I said, okay, what did I miss? Because, yes, it has this kind of haunting tone to it, but, God, it just never really went anywhere. And I guess the performances were good. Ruffalo, I thought, was the best of the three, and he was actually nominated that year for Supporting Actor. But I thought Tatum was kind of one-note and a little bit irritating, and I was stunned at how – I remember Jonah Hill said afterwards, because he became friends with Bennett Miller because he did Moneyball, and he said, that's one of the greatest movies of all time. And I said, are you kidding me? Like, I thought Foxcatcher should have been so much better, and I would never watch it ever again. And the other one is American Hustle. I think that is I will say this with Foxcatcher. I think it's all right. I just thought it could have been great. It's fine. American Hustle, I think, is a terrible movie. And the best review I heard is somebody said to me, it's like a parody of a Scorsese movie. I said, exactly. It's like a really bad Goodfellas. It's got this heavily stylized work from David O. Russell, but he's clearly aping Marty and Goodfellas and just basically ripping him off left and right. And Jennifer Lawrence, who got an Oscar nomination for it, who's an actress I like, even though she didn't like Phantom Thread, so she's completely wrong there. Her performance is so over the top and just so ridiculous. And Christian Bale, the only thing as good as Bale's hairpiece. Otherwise, the whole movie I just thought was ridiculous. American Hustle is one that, again, and I love the crime genre, so that's one you think, oh, that's perfectly up my alley. I thought American Hustle was a real waste of time.
And on the flip side, what's something you went and saw that really didn't have buzz, or you just didn't think going in it was going to, you know, appeal to you?
Mad Max Fury Road, which I had never seen the originals, and then my buddy Max Bredos, who I mentioned, I saw the reviews were strong for it. I saw a trailer or two. And I saw it was getting good reviews, and I said, okay, I'm not a huge action movie guy, although I did love Face Off back in the day. And I said, let me just go see it. And Max is really into that stuff. He loves George Miller. And so we went with our wives, actually, on a day date, and I thought the movie was incredible. It was one of my favorite movies of that year. It's now one of my favorite action movies. And I then went back, of course, and saw Road Warrior and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome and understood why Miller is so recognized as this great action director. I thought Mad Max Fury Road was brilliant. It's just the way it was orchestrated and the sound and fury. And that's, again, a movie that you have to watch on the big screen. And what I'll give you that I just watched on a plane, again, speaking of being a purist, I used to never watch a movie on a plane. Now I just say, listen, if I've got 2 hours and I'm available, let's do it, was Girls Trip. I thought it was hilarious. I had Malcolm Lee, the director. I had Malcolm on my podcast last summer, and I said, well, I'm probably never going to watch this movie, but I do like Malcolm, and I reached out to him on Twitter, and he was great. I thought Tiffany Haddish was hysterical. That was Melissa McCarthy and Bridesmaids type work. I now know why people said maybe she should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actress. I would have nominated her. And Paul Thomas Anderson, one of my favorite directors, he said he loved Tiffany Haddish and Girls Trip, and now they're going to work together. He openly said, listen, I want to work with you. And she goes, I want to work with you. So I thought Girls Trip, which is not a movie I thought I would enjoy, I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, getting back to Mad Max, I was a very, very similar situation. Wasn't a big fan of the first trilogy. Didn't kind of pop for me. Heard good things, had my mind blown. I think that is the only movie in the last, like, 5, maybe even 10 years I saw twice in theaters.
Yeah.
I'm not with you on Face Off, but, you know, hit or miss there, I think.
Yeah, Face Off, definitely a little cartoony, probably a little too kitschy. And to be honest, I don't know how well it holds up. So maybe if I watch it again now, I think it's a little bit too silly. But I love the fact that you saw Mad Max twice, because that's one of those that I should have seen twice. Dunkirk is another one I go, I wish I'd seen it twice in the theater. That's how powerful experience it was.
You see a lot of the movies that, you know, perform well critically.
Right.
And I tend to skew that way too. But every once in a while, like Tommy Boy or Super Troopers or Cool Runnings will be on, and I'll just eat it up. It's just what I needed at that time. And or even something like Top Gun or Point Break. Those are movies that, you know, probably, you know, a little cashy, you know, maybe a little campy. What are some movies that people would be surprised that you rewatch even today, despite kind of being involved in, you know, being a reviewer, having cinephile, gravitating towards the more artistic projects?
Well, the two that I mentioned earlier are the big ones, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and The Naked Gun. I will never tire of, and I think they're brilliant. They should have been nominated for Oscars, and I find them amazing. One that I got sucked into the other day, which I really love, and I haven't seen in a long time, is Kingpin. I'm a big fan of the Farrelly Brothers. I think that that movie is hilarious. I remember Gene Siskel actually had it in his top 10, and I said, oh, my God, he's going to get thrown out of the Broadcast Film Critics Association because he's been a family of Farrelly Brothers movies, his number 8 movie of the year. But I just love Woody Harrelson and Bill Murray in particular, Randy Quaid before he went nuts. That whole movie is really funny. And I love Jim Carrey. You know, I love the 90s Jim Carrey movies. So I love Liar Liar, I think, is just a marvel of physical acting. You know, the French love Jerry Lewis so much. I think people should appreciate Jim Carrey, just what a talent he was in the 90s. Ace Ventura, to me, is hilarious. I'm probably one of the few that really likes Cable Guy. I thought Ben Stiller did a good job directing that. Matthew Broderick, dark comedy. And, of course, I love Jim in his more serious work, you know, like Eternal Sunshine and Truman Show. But, yeah, I think early Jim Carrey, like Liar Liar to me, that's a great, great comedy.
I've not seen that for a while, so I'll have to check that out. I think I had it on VHS, and I got in that weird scenario. Like, how long do you hold on to these VHS tapes for? And I think I lost it at that point.
Yeah, I had mine for a long time, too. I'm glad that you and I share that parallel. I'm sure I have a couple around, like, now just for nostalgia, but definitely at the point that I'd already started buying DVDs, I still had them around. They're like, why do you still have them? Like, well, you never know.
I moved my DVDs from California to Ohio. I actually went to a bar, like, 2 months ago where you went into the bathroom and there was a TV with the VCR attached to it, you know, as part of the unit. And then there were 50 movies, like VHS movies, like Mrs. Doubtfire was playing when I went in there, but they had you could just put in a VHS there. Like, I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to rejoin my friends. I wanted to watch Mrs. Doubtfire.
Mrs. Doubtfire, by the way, I would add to the list. I do enjoy that. I think this one actually was pretty critically acclaimed, but I love Good Morning Vietnam. That movie I could watch.
Oh, yeah.
I love Robin Williams in that movie. He's so funny.
So I have two more questions for you. You've been very giving them with your time, and these are more forward-thinking. But if this is a pure hypothetical, Bob Iger sees all your work with Cinephile and, you know, covering the Oscars, and he calls from Disney and goes, Admin, I want you to produce a movie. We're going to give you a budget. Is there anything you have in mind that's out there? You know, who are some directors, actors, actresses you want to attach to this project? You are now moving into a producer role on a whim of Bob Iger. The Disney stockholders began. This is what Disney's doing.
You and I have talked about the fate right now of Muslims in the world, and I've told you just how it's a challenging time for us, certainly with our current administration. So I always had this idea. I thought, as somebody who's religious, and of course as friends of different religions, I always thought a documentary called Places of Worship would be fascinating. And I thought it would be amazing if you could go to, you know, some of the world's most famous synagogues and churches and mosques and temples, and just kind of, you know, rather than always trying to find things that splinter us, find some commonalities. And then Bill Maher made religious, in which case he just made fun of all religions. I think it was a similar concept, but he was just making fun of religion. And I said, well, here's even more reason that I should do my documentary as a rebuke to that and say, okay, fine, it's easy to make pot shots about it. Let's actually delve into this, and rather than finding differences in this world of ours, especially among the monotheistic religions, there's so many commonalities with Christianity and Judaism and Islam that I think you can really make something powerful and interesting and earnest without being too didactic or too boring. And I would get, of course, Scorsese to direct it, because Marty's a very religious person, even though he's not a practicing Catholic as he was when he was growing up. But obviously his films always have heavy religious themes, whether it's Last Temptation of Christ or Silence, you know, very strong film a couple years ago. And I would get Stephen Colbert as the host, because I think Colbert is a very public about his Catholic faith, and I think he's really smart with it, meaning he doesn't just say he's religious and hide behind it. He has Ricky Gervais on his show, and he says, Ricky, I know you think that religious people are dumb and you want to mock us, etc. And he and Gervais engage in good, funny conversations. And I think Colbert has a good way about him. I actually think he'd be really interesting if he was talking to a rabbi or a priest or an imam, or just the average person. I think Colbert hosting like a religious-based documentary, I think, would be fascinating.
And my last question for you is, a year from now, what are some movies you think we'll be talking about for Oscars next year? And, you know, basically, what are the movies you're most excited that are coming out of the next year?
Well, I think the biggest threat right now is what's going to happen with Black Panther, because it's exceptionally rare that you're going to have a movie that has the carryover to get nominated for Oscars next year. The one that I would have thought my whole life, the one that I always return to, is Fargo. Fargo came out in March of 1996, and I remember thinking, because I'd heard a great buzz about it, and I said, well, I remember, this was VHS time. I remember I was in college, and I saw it, and I said, oh, my God, this movie's amazing. Again, back to Siskel and Ebert. Siskel once said it's one of his favorite movies of all time. These guys have seen, like, 20,000 movies each, and Gene's like, it's in my top 10 all time, because he goes, Fargo can be any number of things. It's a comedy. It's a film noir. It's a drama. It's a women's picture. Like, he goes, this is so many different movies wrapped up in one. It's its own film festival. And Fargo is that rare movie, even though it didn't win Best Picture, it did win for Screenplay for the Coen Brothers, and it won for Frances McDormand for Best Actress. The most recent one, of course, is Get Out. Get Out came out in February of last year, and somehow is nominated for Best Picture and Best Screenplay, and may end up winning for Screenplay, and Jordan Peele's up for Best Director. So it's not unheard of, but I'd love to see if Black Panther, which I thought was good but not great, I'm very candid about the fact I'm suffering from superhero fatigue. I liked it, but I did not go crazy about it the way some are doing. But will that film, which I did, you know, listen, you could champion it for so many reasons, because of the fact people who are in that superhero universe think that it's fresh and reinvigorating, and Ryan Coogler is a terrific director, and you see diversity on the screen in which you've never seen before. Every major prominent black actor has a chance to shine. Will Black Panther have the legs to get represented at the Oscars next year? That, to me, is very interesting.
And then what are some films that you think could not get out of the nominee list that haven't come out yet that you're kind of excited about? You've heard about these projects, or maybe there's trailers out. What are you kind of like, you know, looking forward to on the calendar movie-wise?
You know, I haven't taken a good look yet, just because I've been so immersed in what's coming out right now and just trying to get caught up for this year's Oscars, and I haven't really looked. And sometimes it kind of changed the production date. So I don't actually have a great answer there, but generally I find once I get through the Oscars, and once you get through spring movies, which unfortunately are so painful. I mean, literally, all the good popcorn movies are in the summer, and all the critically acclaimed movies are, of course, in the fall. Then I think you have a better gauge. For me, it's always helpful once Cannes hits, which is always early May. Once the Cannes Film Festival hits, then I kind of have a better idea of what the movies are to watch that year. At least
yeah, I never really know what's coming out until, like, I see something on Twitter, and then I mobilize. So if I was asked that question, I really would have no answer for it. I know Wes Anderson has a... Wes Anderson has something coming out, so
yes.
I think that was like the one thing I had on my radar.
I was about to say, I can't wait for The Irishman, of course. Scorsese's been shooting that. That's going to be Pacino for the first time with Marty, much less De Niro and Scorsese for the first time since Casino. Their ninth film together. Pesci's back. Keitel's in. Bobby Cannavale's in. Ray Romano. But they're shooting that. I think that's, yeah, Romano kind of hurts. But I think that'll be 2019. I keep trying to tell myself it's coming out this year, but knowing Marty, he's going to take a good year to edit it. So that's probably going to come to Netflix next year. But, yeah, The Irishman, I cannot wait.
Well, I know you have something else to do, but appreciate the time. It's Adnan Virk. You can find them on basically ESPN, but seemingly every day of the year, ESPN Radio as well. his podcast, Cinephile Twitter account as well, to follow him personally, or Cinephile. He's one of our favorite people at ESPN, and we look forward to seeing him doing a lot of different things going forward.
Well, like I said, man, I really appreciate the kind words from you and getting to know you a little bit. It's been great having that kind of support, because trust me, we all care. You know, the other day, Tom Crean, I've been buying him skinny dip chocolate almonds, just, you know, to kind of butter him up. And I didn't do it the other day. And he goes, oh, no almonds today? And I said, no. He said, why not? And he goes, he didn't text me back. And he goes, man, I heard broadcasters are the most sensitive people around. That's proof of it. And I said, yeah, that's true. So we listen to everything, buddy. Thanks for always being so kind.
Big thanks to Anand Virk for joining us this week on the Awful Announcing Podcast. We will be back in a couple weeks with a new likely roundtable and, of course, some guests to come along the way as well. We're getting close to March Madness, people, so hopefully a fun college guest or two along the way as well. Don't forget, baseball season just around the corner as well. Plenty coming up. Keep it tuned in and locked in over to Awful Announcing at awfulannouncing.com, as well as on Twitter at Awful Announcing. My name is Ben Heisler. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast today. We will talk to you all again very soon.